Did you know the Thomistic Institute offers two full-ride scholarships for the Master's in Theology at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C.? If you or someone you know has a passion for the Catholic intellectual tradition, especially the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, this could be the opportunity of a lifetime. Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships to learn more and apply today. This is a competitive scholarship. To be considered, please apply for the 2025 to 2026 academic year by January 28, 2025, the Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So this talk is going to start off fairly big picture, not very technical in the first half or so. It'll get a little more technical as we get going, but hopefully we can move through slowly enough that people can follow the gist anyway. Okay. So there's this traditional Christian doctrine anyway, and it might be a doctrine of other theistic traditions as well, that I'll call the doctrine of divine universal causality. And the doctrine is basically this. It's the idea that God is the source and the cause of all that exists apart from himself. And we see this doctrine articulated by some of the great thinkers of the tradition. And so you see this here under part one, and we'll be looking at various passages that I'll refer to by number here. So the first passage here from St. Augustine, he says, God's hidden power causes all that exists in any way to have whatever degree of being it has. For without him, it would not exist in this way or that, nor would it have any being at all. St. Anselm tells us, with the exception of the supreme essence itself, in other words, God, nothing exists that is not made by the supreme essence. Everything other than God is made by God. St. Thomas Aquinas, everything other than God must be referred to God as the cause of its being. So here's a question. Does God's universal causality extend even to free human acts? That is, does God cause our acts, even our free acts? It seems like the answer to that question should be yes, given those passages we looked at before. Those passages didn't seem to be making any exceptions for our free acts. God is the source and cause of all that exists apart from himself. Our free actions are things that exist, so it looks like God's the cause of them as well. But I'm guessing, if I were to poll most of you when you walked into the room, whether you thought that our acts could be free if God caused them, you would say no. And you wouldn't be alone in thinking that. Here's a passage from Alvin Plantinga. He was the most prominent philosopher of religion, or certainly one of the most prominent philosophers of religion in the second half of the 20th century into the beginning of the 21st. Plantinga expresses this sort of thought that I'm guessing many of you would have. He says, if I am free with respect to an action A, then God does not bring it about or cause it to be the case, either that I take or that I refrain from this action. For if he brings it about or causes it to be the case that I take A, then I am not free to refrain from A, in which case I am not free with respect to A. Our actions, in other words, can't be free if God causes them, if God brings them about, Plantinga seems to be saying. But that's not the view of major thinkers within the Catholic Christian tradition. So if we skip over to passage 7, 8, and 9, we see figures like St. Anselm and St. Thomas Aquinas who, as consistency might seem to require, want to say that God, as the universal cause of all that exists apart from himself, he's got to be the cause of our actions as well. So St. Anselm says, I cannot in fact deny that every action is a reality, nor that whatever is has its being from God. And you can do the math there, right? It means every action is caused by God or has its being from God. St. Thomas, maybe even more explicitly, says the very act of free will is traced to God as to a cause. And then in another passage from St. Thomas, we should talk a lot about St. Thomas here, right? This is, after all, being sponsored by the Thomistic Institute. St. Thomas says, God, therefore, is the first cause who moves causes both natural and voluntary. In other words, causes both unfree and free. And just as by moving natural causes, he does not prevent their acts being natural, so by moving voluntary causes, he does not deprive their actions being voluntary. But rather, he is the cause of this very thing in them, for he operates in each thing according to its own nature. So as where I'm guessing most of you would agree with Plantinga that it's got to be an either or here, right? Either I'm free and my actions are up to me and caused by me alone, or God causes them and I'm not free. These thinkers from the tradition seem to want to say it's a both and, that our actions are both free and caused to be by God. And there is some good evidence, actually, that this is the picture we find in Holy Scripture as well. So I want you to go back to passages 5 and 6. So this is a passage, the Scripture is difficult to interpret, as we know, but this is a passage from an Old Testament scholar talking about the picture of the relationship between God's causality and human freedom in the Old Testament. Israel's belief in God's power. He's talking about God's power, and I'll ask you to skip down to about line 5 there, where he describes it this way. It's not simply that God allows a man to think thus and not otherwise. He, God, is himself also at work within these acts of personal freedom. Yet, this never led to a flat determinism depriving man of the responsibility for his actions. At all times, the capacity for self-determination is insistently retained. The whole ethical exhortation of the prophets is based on the conviction that decision is placed in the hands of men. But the law, too, setting before man the choice of life or death, rests on this presupposition. The fundamental postulate of moral freedom is found in equal force alongside the religious conviction of God's effective action in all things, and no attempt was made to create a harmonizing adjustment between them. It is testimony to the compelling power of the Old Testament experience of God that it was able to affirm both realities at once and to endure the tension between them without discounting anything of their unconditional validity. So what he's saying in a nutshell is the Old Testament picture seems to be, on the one hand, that we have robust freedom such that we're morally responsible for what we do, but that God is at work in all that we do. The divine power, right, is behind it. And we get a similar sort of picture in at least parts of the New Testament, for example, in the letters of St. Paul. So here's a New Testament scholar describing what he finds in some of St. Paul's writings. Passage 6, some of Paul's statements on the relation of divine to human agency strike us as paradoxical, if not downright incoherent. He urges the Philippians, for instance, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for God is at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. In statements such as this, we are perplexed by the juxtaposition of two agencies, that of the Philippians, the recipient of Paul's exhortation, who are clearly responsible for their work, and work here broadly is just there for what they do, for their actions, and then of God, whose work is taken to be not independent of theirs, but in some sense the source of their action, even of their will to act. On the one hand, Paul's letters are full of statements which state or presuppose that human beings are capable and effective agents responsible for their own actions. On the other hand, he speaks as if God's agency is effective everywhere, even in cases where humans are said to work. And so again, in Scripture, we get this sort of both-and picture. It's not a choice we have to make between God's causality and our freedom, but our free acts, though they're up to us, also have God as a cause. And we even get this sort of picture in much of the prayer of the church. If you start to become attuned to this, you find it all over the place, actually, in the liturgy of the church. I'm just going to point to one passage here. It may not even be the best example, but from the Liturgy of the Hours, prayers like this abound. Lord God, keep us faithful to your law and thought, word and deed. Be our helper now and always. Free us from sin. You might ask, how can God keep us faithful to his law in thought, word, and deed if what we do, our deeds, are up to us, right, alone and not also in some way up to him, right? It seems like we'd be asking God to do something that it's not, you know, within his gambit to do. And so prayers like this also seem to presuppose this sort of both-and picture where our free acts also have God as their source. So what I want to suggest here is there's a tension maybe between what most of us, myself included, at least at many points in my life, our intuitions about freedom and about the idea if we're going to be free, our actions have to be up to us and us alone, and what the tradition, you know, the philosophical, theological tradition, what Scripture, what the prayer of the church seems to present to us, which is more of a both-and picture, a picture where our free acts are caused by God. There's a tension here. And the question is, you know, is it possible to affirm the both-and in some sort of coherent fashion? Or is this an either-or where we have to choose between God's universal causality and our freedom? Well, I want to suggest that we can, in this talk, that we can affirm the both-and. And I want to diagnose with the help of St. Thomas Aquinas, again, fitting for a Thomistic Institute talk, right, Professor? Yes? I want to diagnose what part of the problem might be, anyway, with our intuitions. And the upshot of it is that we may be thinking too anthropomorphically about the divine causality. St. Thomas is not himself oblivious to the kinds of problems that Plantinga raised for reconciling these two things and that many of us might feel. He's not oblivious to that. He actually entertains such objections to himself, and it's interesting to see how he diagnoses them. So if you look on passage 9 on the handout, this is St. Thomas from his commentary on a work of Aristotle, but he says, if God's providence is the cause of everything that happens in the world, it seems that everything must happen the way it does. Firstly, because he knows it and his knowledge cannot be mistaken, so that what he knows must necessarily happen, and perhaps more relevant to the particular talk tonight, secondly, because he wills it, and his will can't be ineffective. So everything he wills, it seems, must necessarily happen. So he recognizes a potential objection to affirming the both and. But then he's going to give a diagnosis. He says, but these objections depend on thinking of knowledge in God's mind and the working of God's will on the model of such activities in us when they are in fact very different. These objections depend on thinking of God's knowledge and the working of God's will on the model of such activities in us when they are in fact very different. In other words, the problem here is that we've got too anthropomorphic a conception of God's agency, of God's causal agency. And what I am going to be doing here in a bit is presenting, I think, a kind of popular way of thinking about God's agency that models it on our own, that is anthropomorphic, and that has the consequence that we are not free if our actions are caused by God. And then I'm going to present an alternative account of God's agency, less anthropomorphic, less modeled on our own, that I want to suggest does not have that consequence. Following, right, the suggestion here of St. Thomas. Here's another a contemporary writer writing about Aquinas, but suggesting in a similar way that the problem might be anthropomorphism. Passage 10, to say that my actions are free only insofar as God does not cause them presupposes a plainly idolatrous conception of the divine causality. God's action in the world is not a sort of cosmic elbow jogging. What a phrase. Cosmic elbow jogging? I guess that's what you do on a, you know, when you're packed in the subway or something, or on a bus like sardines, you know, elbow jog. It's not a cosmic elbow jogging so that where space is occupied by the divine action, freedom is evacuated from it, and vice versa. That is a theology on which God's causality is construed as if it were just an infinitely scaled up creaturely agency, an agency just like ours, just a lot more powerful, right? But that's not the way we should think about it. Okay, so hopefully you've got a sense of the issue, the problem, right? You've got this traditional doctrine of God's universal causality. It seems to imply that even our acts are caused by God, but there's a tension there. How could our acts possibly be caused by God and yet still be free? Aquinas says, well, the reason for thinking there's a tension here or even a contradiction is that we've got too anthropomorphic a conception of God's causal agency. So now I want to move into some more technical matters, but hopefully not too technical. I want to talk a bit about the philosophical requirements for freedom and responsibility. For free acts of the sort that we can be genuinely responsible for. Free acts of the sort that you might say we can be genuinely accountable for. You might call it moral responsibility if we'd like. And in thinking about these requirements, I'd like to use what I think is a fairly strong, what for some of you who've studied free will issues might recognize as an incompatibilist or a libertarian conception of freedom, where we might say that an act is responsibly free if and only if it is done intentionally or on purpose, and it is within its agent's control or up to its agent whether the act occurs. So my act can be something that I'm responsible for and free in that sense only if I'm doing it intentionally or on purpose, and it's up to me whether or not my act occurs. It's within my control whether it occurs. That seems one not implausible requirement for an act to be responsibly free. We might add to that the idea that an agent performs free and responsible acts only if the agent at least sometimes has the ability to do otherwise than he does, or only if the agent had the ability to have done otherwise than he did, given the very same prior conditions. So the thought here is that freedom and responsibility requires that at least some of our acts somewhere along the way were ones where we could have done otherwise than we did. We often think we could do otherwise than we do. I raise my right arm right now, and I think I'm doing it freely, right? And I think I could have raised and chosen to raise my left arm instead, right? Given the very conditions in which I was acting, though I raised my right arm, I think I could have raised my left arm. And we might think that if that's got to be the case for at least some of our actions, if they're going to be genuinely free and we're going to be morally accountable for them. Okay, so that's the kind of con- conception of freedom that we're going for here and that's at stake. And I think we can think a little bit about what sorts of things might preclude or rule out that sort of freedom. So I want to present here a kind of scheme, a kind of model for the sort of scenario that would rule out or preclude free, responsible acts. And to do that, I'm going to use some symbols here. We'll just let A stand for my act, any act of mine, and let F just stand for any prior factor, any factor that is prior to my act. It could be any sort of thing. It could be a thing, some event, some action, some state of whatever you like, just some factor prior to my act. Okay? So we've got my act, we've got a factor prior to my act, and then let X arrow Y stand for the idea that Y simply follows from X. In other words, that there's no possibility that X occurs without Y's occurring. Okay? So here's the sort of situation where we might think that our action couldn't possibly be free. Okay? It's a situation where there is some factor F that is prior to my act, and that factor is outside my control. So let OC in this little diagram stand for outside my control. So there's some factor or factors prior to my act. Those factors are completely outside my control, okay? And then it's also outside my control that my act simply follows from those factors. It's not possible for those factors to obtain or hold or occur and my act not to obtain or hold or occur. Well, if the factor, the prior factor, is outside my control, and if the fact that my act simply follows from that prior factor is also outside my control, it seems like my act is going to be outside my control as well. At least a lot of people have an intuition something like that. I think I do, right? And so I think any sort of situation, whether it includes God or doesn't include God, right? Any sort of situation where there are prior factors outside my control from which my act simply follows, I'm going to doubt that I have responsibly free acts or that the act in question is responsibly free. I'm going to have serious doubts about that. For those of you who've studied the free will stuff, and it doesn't matter if you have this, just to make connections with people who have been studying some of this, right? This is a variation of what is sometimes called the consequence argument against the compatibility of freedom and determinism, right? The idea that there are prior factors from which my act simply follows is a way of articulating what we might mean by determinism. Our acts being entirely determined by prior factors. So just to make a connection there. Okay. So we've talked a little bit about what freedom now, in more detail, what freedom seems to require. It seems to require that my acts be ultimately up to me and within my control, ability to do otherwise given prior conditions. We've talked about what sort of situation might preclude or rule out that kind of freedom. And now I want to turn our attention to a couple of what I think are sort of popular ways of thinking about divine agency, which I want to suggest are anthropomorphic in the sense I think that they tend to model God's agency on our own. And I want to suggest that on both of these models, they seem to embody that kind of that scheme for responsibility preclusion. That is to say, if this is the way we think of divine agency, then we've got a situation where God's causing our acts is going to preclude our acts being responsibly free. I've tried to diagram these, and you know, I'm letting a little triangle, you know, stand for God. I'm letting E just stand for any effect of God. I'm letting this little arrow stand for a causal dependence relation of the effect on God. Okay, and I'm giving these names. We'll call one of them the prior divine decree model and the prior divine act model. And I think in a way we can talk about these models together, what they have in common, okay? One thing that they have in common is that on both of these models, God's causing E, God's bringing about an effect E, introduces a factor that is prior to E and from which E simply follows, okay? So E here is just standing for any effect because we're talking about God's causal agency in general, but we're worried about our actions, right? So we could, if we wanted, we could let, you know, some action of ours, A, like substitute for E. In other words, we want to think about what this means for our actions. It means if God, on these models, if God were to cause our act, if God were to cause our act, it would introduce some factor prior to our act from which our act simply follows. And now, and if that prior thing, factor from which our act simply follows is outside of our control, what does that mean about our act? It's outside our control, right? And if it's outside of our control, then what? It's not free, okay? So in one case, this prior factor that God's causing our act introduces is God's choice to cause our act, or the choice to cause the effect, or a decree to cause the effect. So we sometimes think of ourselves as we making choices or acts of will from which follow further like bodily actions of ours. Not everybody thinks quite this way, but you might think, all right, first, you know, I form some sort of volition or choice, right, that I'm going to raise my right arm. And then following that choice, my right arm goes up, right? And so there's a prior thing, the choice that I form that is prior to this next effect that comes from that choice, right? My arm is going up. Well, you might think of God's causality that way as involving some little divine volition or choice or decree within God from which then whatever he decrees follows as a further effect. And that further effect simply follows from the prior decree, from the prior choice that God has made. So you can see how this might be an instance of modeling God's agency, God's will on ours, on the way it might work for us, right? The prior divine decree model. The prior divine act model thinks of God's act of causing E as something going on sort of in God, some sort of feature of God or something. And there's this act of causing E that is in God from which E simply follows, okay? But the main thing I want to draw your attention to is in both of these cases, we've got models on which God's bringing about our act involves some factor that's prior to our act from which our act simply follows, or that determines our act. Okay, that's one thing these have in common. Do you see why on these particular models there would be a problem for freedom? You see how these models instantiate as that scheme on the previous page, right? There's a factor prior to the act that they introduce from which our act simply follows. And presumably this is a factor over which we have no control, right? It doesn't look like there's any way on these models that we have control in any sense over what God's choice is or what God's act of causing any effect is. So it looks like these models are models on which God's causing our act is not compatible with our act being free. That's one thing that they have in common. I've talked a little bit about how these models, in a way, model God's agency on our own. And that might be a reason for thinking that they're anthropomorphic, simply because they take our own agency as a model for God's agency. But I want to suggest another way in which these models are anthropomorphic. Another reason that they're anthropomorphic is that these models violate the doctrine of divine simplicity, the great safeguard against anthropomorphism in theology. Now, I don't have any expectation that you've heard of the doctrine of divine simplicity, but maybe a few of you have. Has anybody heard of this before? Maybe one, two? Don't worry if you haven't. I'll just give you a brief introduction to it. The doctrine of divine simplicity is a doctrine that says that God is not a composite thing made up of parts. And part of the reason for denying that God is a composite thing made up of parts is that any sort of composite thing made up of parts would seem to be something that is made, right? Something that is dependent on the parts from which it's made. But God is supposed to be the first being, right? On which everything else depends, but God doesn't depend on anything. So God's got to be simple in the sense of not a composite thing. Okay. Well, both of these two models, the prior divine decree model, the prior divine act model, they locate God's choice to bring about the effect E, or God's act to bring about E. They locate them as some sort of like feature, or we might even think of as a kind of part of God. There's God, the triangle, right? And then there's this other little doodad in God, this little bar that I'm representing here, which represents the choice or the decree or the act, right? Which is something, you know, distinct from God, but is somehow stuck in the divine being, right? The tradition would call this sort of thing that is sort of a some sort of thing that feature that inheres in God in some sense, but is not quite the same as God, an accident. And we might, and at least someone like St. Thomas Aquinas is going to think this, that would be to introduce a kind of part in God. It would make God into a composite thing. And if God is a composite thing, God is a dependent thing, God is not first. So these particular pictures, these particular models are going to be ruled out by someone like St. Thomas, by someone like St. Anselm as well, Augustine, really many of the major thinkers in the tradition. They're going to be ruled out of hand because they violate God's simplicity. And so another reason to think of them as anthropomorphic is their violation of the simplicity of God. We're modeling God's agency on our own without reflecting on the fact that God is a simple God, not a God made up of parts. Okay. So what I want to do now, and in sort of closing, is present to you a different model, a less anthropomorphic model for thinking about divine agency, and a model that is consistent with divine simplicity that I'm going to call the extrinsic model of divine agency. So let me begin with a question. If divine simplicity rules out models which introduce some little part in God, so now a God is made up of not only the triangle but this other thing, right? If divine simplicity rules that out, so we can't think of God's choice or willing, some effect E, as something in God like that, or we can't think of God's act of bringing about E is something in God, what are our options? What does God's act of bringing about an effect consist in? Where is it located? These anthropomorphic models want to locate it here as a part of God. That's ruled out by divine simplicity. Well, Aquinas, in many texts, right, seems to want to locate God's act of bringing about an effect E, or we might say God's act of creating E, extrinsic to God, outside God. So he will say in certain places that creation, the act of creation, just is the created effect with its relation of dependence on God. So where does that put the act of creation? Is it here? Up here is in God, is a part of God? No, it's here. It's extrinsic to God. Let me ask you a question. That's a pot of water. This is water, okay? This is fire, right? This is heat that is being brought about in the water by the fire. Where's the fire's act of bringing about the heat? Okay, it's here, right? Or at least if Aristotle is right, it's here. I mean, obviously, this is a debated issue, but Aristotle, right, and Aquinas following him has this slogan, the action of the agent, in other words, the action of the cause, is in the patient. The patient is the thing in which the effect is brought about. And so the idea here is that the fire's action of bringing about heat and water, it's not like some little thing in the fire. It's actually the heat brought about in the water insofar as it depends on the fire. And so the location of the fire's act of heating is in the water, not in the fire. So even apart from theological concerns, philosophers, pagan philosophers, like Aristotle, had this idea that the causality of an agent is not located up in the agent, right? But it's located actually is in the effect insofar as it depends on the agent. Well, it turns out that this way of thinking about creation as the effect insofar as it depends on God as being extrinsic, right, outside God, fits divine simplicity perfectly, because it doesn't involve adding some new part to God, which would make God a composite thing. So we are borrowing this idea from Aristotle that gets the act of creation outside of God. So what is the God's act of causing heat consist in on this view? It consists just in the effect with its relation of dependence on God. So what is God's causing my act consist in on this view? It's just my act insofar as it depends on God. So on the anthropomorphic models, they want to put God's creative act up here as a kind of part of God. In the model I'm suggesting, God's creative act is extrinsic to God, outside God. It's the act with its dependence on God. All right. And now I'm coming into the home stretch. All right. So if we think about divine agency in this way, and God's causal acts as being extrinsic to God, then I think we have a model on which God's bringing about our act does not introduce a factor that is both prior to our act and from which our act simply follows. And since it doesn't introduce any factor prior to our act from which our act simply follows, it doesn't introduce any such factor that's outside our control, and so it doesn't introduce a factor that is going to preclude our acts being free. Show me. Okay. How does it not introduce a factor that is prior to my act from which my act simply follows? Well, on the table at the bottom under the little diagram of the extrinsic model, in the left-hand column of that table, I'm listing all of the things that are sort of involved, that are part of the picture in a case where God is bringing about my act. Okay? So what all is involved? Well, God is going to be on the scene, right? My act is going to be on the scene. God's act of causing my act is going to be on the scene. God's choosing my act is on the scene. And then the causal dependence relation of my act to God is on the scene. So all these things are there in the picture, right? And what I want to now suggest is that none of these items is both prior to my act and something from which my act simply follows. So God is prior to my act because he's the cause, and causes are prior to their effects, okay? So God is prior to my act as the cause of my act. But does my act simply follow from God? Let me ask you this. Is it possible for God to exist without causing my act, do you think? Not see some people nodding. It's possible for God to exist without causing my act. So my act doesn't simply follow from God, right? My act's not that important. None of ours is, right? So God could exist without my act existing. My act isn't simply determined by God's existence. It doesn't simply follow from God. So God's prior to my act, but my act doesn't simply follow. My act is on the scene. Is it possible for my act to exist without my act existing? Okay, no. So my act simply follows from the act in the sense that I mean here, that it's not possible for my act to obtain without my act obtaining. What about God's act of causing my act? Can this thing, right? Can this thing exist without my act existing? No, okay, you're nodding in the right direction. It can't, right? Because, of course, God's act of creating my act includes, as a way, my act with its relation of dependence. So God's act of causing my act on this picture, that can't exist without my act existing. But let me ask you this. Is God's act of creating or causing my act, is it prior to my act on this picture? It's not prior, is it? Because God's act of creating my act partially consists in my act, right? So it's not prior. On this picture, neither is God's willing my act, because God's willing my act or choosing my act really is just his creating or causing my act to exist for a reason. To bring about something on purpose, to bring about something for a reason, is to will that thing. So this is also God's willing my act, but it's not prior to my act. God is, but God's act of willing my act isn't. Okay. So just to summarize, on this extrinsic model, unlike the two previous models that were anthropomorphic and that violated divine simplicity, on this extrinsic model, when God brings about my act, that doesn't introduce any factor that determines my act contrary to freedom. It doesn't introduce any factor that's prior to my act from which my act simply follows. And so it doesn't introduce any factor prior to my act from which my act simply follows that's outside my control in a way that would preclude freedom and responsibility. So there's a lot of technical detail here. Some of you may have followed it, some of you struggling to follow it, depending on your backgrounds and so forth. But the upshot is that our chances of affirming the both and, right, that God is the universal cause of all that exists apart from himself, including our actions, and yet we're genuinely free, our chances of being able to affirm that are much better, and I think actually we can pull it off, provided that we don't think of God's causal agency true anthropomorphically. If we think of it on the model of our own, we're inevitably going to have a deterministic picture where God determines our acts contrary to freedom. If we think about it according to what I'm proposing here, the extrinsic model, I think we can avoid that implication. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.